my head in a noose. Even now I'm expecting all hell to break loose. People are crazy and time is strange. Love is tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. Should be in Hollywood. Just a second there, I thought I saw something. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts, gonna dress in drag. Only a fool in here thinks he's got anything to prove. Lot of water under the bridge, lot of other stuff too. Don't get up, gentlemen, I'm only passing through. People are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, my brain. I used to care, but things have changed.
Here we are, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today is the 9th of July, 2018, and it's Monday. and you're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. Oh, what a difference 24 hours could make. I know you don't tune in to hear the weather report, but usually the monsoon hits here around the 1st of July, maybe up as late as the 3rd. But I don't know. Everything this year seems to be offset a little bit, and I'm not sure how that is. But I don't know. We had a kind of a – usually the monsoons start coming up out of the south, and you'll see the clouds building over on the eastern part of Arizona. There's a big mountain ranges in there, a lot of mountains that are anywhere from 7 to 11,000 feet. And the clouds will start building up, big thunder clouds. And they heat up during the day because the sun's shining on top of them, develop a lot of energy. And then usually around sunset or slightly before, as the sun's energy's not heating the top of the clouds up, and then they start to blow out. They just start to collapse back down, causes a lot of downdraft, picks up a lot of the dust, and then that's one of the how the dust storms get going. A week or so ago, it kind of started developing, but it wasn't coming out of the south. It was kind of more towards the northeast, and then came in two separate walls of dirt, dust, and then because it was so late in the afternoon, it never really developed. There was a lot of dust, but not thick like super dust storm that seen before. And then it just kind of about five drops or so, and then that was it. And everything cleared up and got real hot again. And then last night it was really odd. Somewhere between 8 and 9 o'clock at night, all of a sudden this massive wall of dust came in, blowing dust, and then here comes the rain. You could see the lightning out on the horizon, and then it just rained and rained and rained and rained. Real big drops for quite a while, and then it just tapered off. So needless to say, it's a lot cooler, pretty much solid overcast this morning. I know it doesn't rain in the desert, and you didn't tune into your mind as your primary weapon to hear the weather report. 9 July 2018, it's a Monday, at Liberty Tree Radio. We'll continue our block of instruction. When we left off last week, we were talking about the political character of the Second Indochina War and the development of it. We had covered some news articles from United Press International, the New York Times, in the 1964 time frame. We'll kind of continue that, have a little bit more to discuss about the political character. I'd like to say thanks for taking the time to tune in to the weather report here on Liberty Tree Radio, and thank you for helping support Liberty Tree Radio and keeping it on the air. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. And that's Alpha Lima Tango Hotel Alpha Bravo Echo Bravo 762@hotmail.com. Now, I haven't been there. Sometimes when I get to go up to town, my time is very limited, and I don't always get to get everything off the checklist that I was hoped to get. Sometimes looking for a certain article or something, and being that the time is limited, oftentimes what I'll do is I'll just, if I find something, that I'll just print off the first page, especially if it's a multi-paged document, and then I have the URL, so, and then I can bring it back and then read it so as I understand over at Liberty Tree Radio, I think it's Liberty Tree Radio archive.4mg.com, something like that. And they're getting the archives up for Your Mind is Your Primary Weapon. Now, I'm not sure how many are there. I think it's the month of June. Have some border news. As always, we're sending this broadcast out for Lily, Grace, Antoinette. After the bottom of the hour, I'll get you Bob Miner's contact information so you'll have time for a pen and a paper. But then again, I understand that most of you already have a pen and a paper too, trying to jot down notes as we're covering over these studies of insurgency. If you'd like to call in, telephone is 712-432-0900, 712-432-0900, and then the mechanical voice comes in, and then you can enter 957-464, and then the pound sign, 957-464, and the pound sign, and then you'll be up live, and then you can also enter *6 to unmute your phone. Also, as a reminder, also broadcast over on the Micro Effect on Thursday and Friday from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Arizona time. So it starts the same time whether we're here on Liberty Tree Radio or the Micro Effect, but because of our limited amount of time on Mondays, you don't always get to flesh a lot of these concepts out and then drill down further into them on Thursday and Friday, 2 hours apiece on each day. And again, it starts at the same time. So that's, I think that's kind of what's on the list for today. There was something I had heard the other day, something about a fentanyl-laced flyer, and I wanted to touch base on that. And so I poked around, and I found quite a few conflicting reports. Seems to me I heard somebody say that it was a police officer or something and touched this flyer and they supposedly died, but I don't seem to find any information that, and now there's even seems to be some question if it had anything to do with a fentanyl-laced flyer. Have kind of some different concepts of what could be tried or attempted to be carried out here because of the nature of the website and the choice of the flyer. And it was a controversial anti-government website, you know, talking about microwaves and cell towers and et cetera, and vaccinations and, you know, the whole standard fare. So there could possibly be something we'll get into that a little bit later. Now, to address the political character of the Second Indochina War, and like I said before, on this whole study of insurgency, it's one thing to hear the basic presentation of about this is insurgency and it's a political military struggle and a controlled upheaval and the types and methods and the components of the political subversives and the guerrillas and the terrorists and how and the committees and all that planning and to dispel the notion that insurgency is purely a communist inspired people's uprising, and we've pretty much laid that part out and dispelled a lot of those false assumptions. A lot of that writing came about back in the old 1960s, 1970s because of post-World War II, the high amount of insurgents that were backed by communists, whether it had to do with China, Malaya, Vietnam, Cuba, etc., etc., etc. And so there became a mindset that somehow that this was all communist inspired. But as we've shown, there's been numerous other insurgencies throughout history. It had nothing to do with communism at all. So, but the concept, what we're trying to cover is that it's one thing to see what insurgency is at its base, how it's conducted, why it's conducted, the components of it, the phases, but that only gets you a starting foundation of where to work from. It's kind of like the English language. We can learn the ABCs, and that'll introduce you to the letters and their sounds. And then when we start to construct the words by using those letters, that's the next step. And then on top of that, then all the parts of about conjugation and verbs and nouns and syntax and all that. So that's another part. So we start off by describing the alphabet, and then we start forming words out of those letters, and then taking those words and arranging them and making complete sentences. And that's how we're looking at to gain a better understanding of about insurgency, because it's one thing to just say, well, this is this and this is that, and I tip my hat and say, thanks for listening, and you don't quite get the concept. And then by going in and studying the individual insurgencies, whether it's the Tamil Tigers or the Irish Republican Army, Lawrence of Arabia, and some, and I'm not going to go into the differentiation, at the American Revolution. Now, insurgency is neither civil war nor revolution, but when it's conducted properly, it can spark either. And so it's easy on the surface to say that the American Revolution was an insurgency, but that's kind of incorrect. It was the insurgents that, and their different parts of it, the political subversives, the terrorists, the guerrillas that agitated the people to rise up and throw off a foreign invader or occupying power. But when it crossed the line to open rebellion, it's a real fine line, but we can't really say and make a blanket statement that the American Revolution was an insurgency. It was an insurgency existed to spark the revolution, but that's where it ended. Now, to address the deal of about Vietnam, because we were talking in those United Press International and New York Times articles of about the airborne assaults into the jungle strongholds and this is that, and then we did all these advisory command and large-scale assaults, and but only light contact, or there was only one wounded person captured. That's the nature of the hit-and-run tactics of the guerrillas. So the scale of the fighting through 1964, it indicated the communists were rapidly gaining the military initiative. Out, an article out of the New York Times on December 3 states, when the United States military buildup began in South Vietnam in November of 61, reported the media, the situation had been considered critical because the Viet Cong had become strong enough to initiate no fewer than 1,782 attacks and small-scale incidents in 1 month. But by November of 63, after 2 years of massive American military and economic aid, the number of Viet Cong attacks and incidents jumped to 3,182 for a month. And the continuing buildup was reported in December to have doubled the size of the South Vietnamese Air Force, but the results were by no means in ratio to the increase in the striking power. And that was the New York Times in December 3. So the government air raids against insurgent concentrations have forced communist commanders to make adjustments in battle tactics, but have not noticeably lowered their morale or fighting capability, according to a new intelligence analysis of weapons effectiveness in the guerrilla war. Attempts to thin out the trees and jungle refuges have scarcely affected communist military operations so far, the analysts found. Even the inexperienced guerrillas have learned to protect themselves from aerial cannon and rocket bombardment. The Viet Cong are known to have taken elaborate precautions against attack. Their main base areas consist largely of underground tunnels and caves, strong enough in some cases to withstand direct hits from 500-pound bombs. Guerrilla veterans have learned to spot various types of aircraft and estimate whether their mission is bombardment, defoliation, reconnaissance, or transport, and the intelligence analyst shows that some Viet Cong units have specially trained persons who count falling bombs or incoming artillery shells and correlate them with the explosions heard, and this way they try to detect duds, which they can collect for their own use for landmines, bombs, grenades, etc. Now, the ratio of government casualties to Viet Cong casualties sharply altered with the passage of time, and the former increase and the latter decreasing, even by the government's own estimates, because the official figures as reported by the New York Times of October 1864 show that in 1961, the government casualties were 9,000 and the Viet Cong were 13,000. 62, the government had 13,000 casualties and the Viet Cong 33,000. And then 63, the government had 19,000 and the Viet Cong had 28,000. And then 64, for the first 6 months, the government had 11,390 and the Viet Cong had 9,000. Now, it's well to bear in mind that the casualties of the Viet Cong reported by Saigon are estimates made by the other side, and two, almost inevitably include civilian victims of aerial bombing and artillery attacks, and conveniently assumed to be Viet Cong rather than positively identified. Now, one test is to compare the number of weapons captured by the government with the number of Viet Cong casualties reported as against the government's casualties reported and the weapons lost. Now, in the latter instance, since there is a general correspondence, but in the former, a surprising disparity, because the arms captured from the Viet Cong rarely, if ever, match the reported Viet Cong casualty list, and a fact that raises the strong suspicion that the dead in question are not armed in the first place. Now, again, the high proportion of reported enemy casualties arising from air operation raises a question about the accuracy of the casualty reports, because who, in fact, counts the bodies, much less identifies them as those of combatants? And in this connection, Bernard Fall writes in the Two Vietnams, quote, "How the tactical aircraft now in Vietnam are used can be discerned from the official reports of the South Vietnamese Air Force. In a not untypical three-day operation in January 1963, the Vietnamese Air Force hit the following targets, one house and 20 watchtowers, 10 and 22 miles west of Tre Cu, three houses 28 miles west of Quy Nhon, four houses in a rice field 22 miles west of Pleiku, 25 houses destroyed and ten damaged 17 miles southwest of Quang Nhi, and 15 houses 22 miles south northwest of Pleiku, two houses 19 miles from the Ben Hoa, and in operations against Viet Cong concentration in the Plain of Reeds in the jungle bastion of Zone D north of Saigon, the ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, reported 76 enemy killed by ground fire, 400 killed by aerial gunnery, but only 9 individual weapons and 5 crew-served weapons, machine guns, mortars, etc., were captured, and over 400 houses and huts were destroyed, end quote. Now, it takes little imagination to guess who the enemy casualties must be in such circumstances, because the indiscriminate use of aircraft against presumed Viet Cong targets does much to explain the alienation of the rural population from the Saigon government. And country people, whose only contact with the government comes in the form of napalm and rocket attacks, can scarcely be expected to feel sympathetic to the government cause, whatever it may be. Now, on the other hand, they have every reason to feel solidarity with the guerrillas, usually recruited from their own villages, who share their peril and their hardship. Now, to the world outside of Vietnam's hamlets and villages, the insurgents are agents of international communism in the grass and bamboo huts where they live in the hamlets they have liberated. The Viet Cong guerrillas talk like local people about simple things. It was hell when we were attacked every night in my hamlet, said a peasant's son in his early 20s. If the government was good enough or strong enough, I thought it should have been able to protect us at night. So I thought maybe the Liberation Front people were right, he said. Now I know they are. I don't regret my decision to join them. Another young man said, I was scared and angry when they attacked our hamlet, but I had to go along with them, and now I'm glad I did. Now the questioner was a Vietnamese reporter. He had taken local buses to hamlets in insecure or disputed areas in the Delta and found himself in a hamlet about which there was no dispute. Night and day, it was governed by the communists, except for the leader. The guerrillas seemed to be in their late teens or early 20s. They would not give their names for fear of disclosure to the government. They all said that they were natives of the hamlet, all spoke Vietnamese with the local accent. Ask what they think about Ho Chi Minh, president of North Vietnam. The leader said, he is a great revolutionary. We like him, but do not take orders from him. We are South Vietnamese and fighting for the liberation of South Vietnam. The New York Times, 23 November 1964. Now, in the greater part of rural South Vietnam, the Viet Cong administers the only government that exists, operating its own schools and hospitals, its own census, farm bureaus, tax agencies, news agencies. And increasingly it rules by default because there is no effective government agency present. The only contact with Saigon being the occasional punitive expeditions of the armed forces, ferried in by helicopter or risking the heavily mined roads and armored motor columns. When the army leaves, as it must, life goes on as before, and gradually, through incessant pressure on army outposts and the government installations in twilight areas, the Viet Cong extends its domain. Now, I see we're down at the bottom, and I'll continue here for shortly and try to cover some. But you see, the problem was it was the lip services paid in Washington and Saigon to idea that the crux of the struggle is popular support, without the which the war cannot be won. We must keep in mind, said Lieutenant General William C. Westmoreland, on assuming command of the United States Task Force in South Vietnam. Well, here we got some Lou Reed coming in here, talking about some heroin, and when we get back, we'll talk about some heroin and drug smuggling and what's going on the southern border. So sit tight, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be right back.
I just where I'm going. I'm going to try for the kingdom if I can, 'cause it makes me feel like I'm a man. When I put a spike into my vein, not a thing of things aren't quite the same. When I'm rushed in my run, and I feel just what Jesus done. And I guess that I just don't know. And I guess that I just don't know. I have made a very big decision. I'm going to try to nullify my life, 'cause when the blood begins to flow, when it shoots up the top of his neck, when I'm closing in on death, you can't help me, not you guys. All your pretty girls with all your sweet pretty talk. You cut off all care to walk. And I guess that I just don't know. And I guess that I just don't know. I wish that I was born 1,000 years ago. I wish that I'd sail the darkened seas on a great big clipper ship, going from this land here to that, put on a sailor's sedan cap. From the big city, where a man may not be free of all of the evils in this town, and of themselves and those around. And I guess that I just don't know. And I guess that I just don't know. Yeah, row in, the death of me. It's my wife and it's my life, because I mean it to my face, to a center in my head, and then I'm better off than dead. Cause when the blood begins to flow, then I really don't care anymore about a different in this town. And everybody putting everybody else down, and all the politicians making crazy sounds, and all the dead bodies piled up in mounds. That heroin is in my blood, and that blood is in my head. Thank God I'm good at that. Thank your God I'm not aware. Thank God I just don't care.
Thank you.
Well, here we are, ladies and gentlemen. This is the second half of Your Mind is Your Primary Weapon. Today is the 9th of July, 2018. You are tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. Attempt here to finish up our presentation about the political character of the Second Indochina War. As when we left off, there seemed to be a lot of lip service paid in Washington and Saigon to the idea that the crux of the struggle is a popular support, without which the war cannot be won. We must keep in mind, said Lieutenant General William C. Westmoreland, on assuming command of the United States Task Force in South Vietnam, that campaigns must be won at province, district, village, and hamlet levels, where battle is being waged for the hearts and minds of the people. So far, the means of attaining this laudable objective have not been discovered. Napalm firebombs and chemical sprays that defoliate the crops, along with the jungle, do not seem to win hearts and minds. In 1962, the No regime began a program modeled on the British practice in Malaya to move the rural population in so-called strategic hamlets, a $60 million effort involving the construction of thousands of fortified stockade communities and the destruction of scattered dwellings as a means of cutting the insurgency off from its popular base. The announced objective was 12,000 fortified hamlets by the end of 1963, sufficient to house virtually the entire rural population of South Vietnam. the number actually built remained in doubt because of false reports from government officials in charge of the program, and because many of the fortified hamlets fell into the Viet Cong hands or were destroyed almost as soon as they were completed. And by early 1964, the program had bogged down to such an extent that the Associated Press reported, "The Diem regime has cast into oblivion 4 months ago, but Americans in Vietnam still see no noticeable improvement in the general policy governing the strategic hamlets. Most Americans with anything to do with the $60 million program that began with a blaze of publicity 2 years ago say it continues to deteriorate." And the forcible removal of the villages from their old dwellings, inadequate compensation for their losses involved in the transfer, and the concentration camp character of the stockade hamlets with their barbed wire and concrete pillboxes had the opposite effect of that intended. Instead of winning the confidence of the villagers, the program further alienated them, and rather than be forced into the hamlets, young men vanished into the forest to join the Viet Cong, and the younger women were quick to follow them, leaving many of the new communities populated exclusively by dependents, the very young and the very old. Plans to rebuild the National Police Force were considered an important part of the counterinsurgency program, and 11 police institutes were established in various parts of the country with the object of raising police strength by 50,000 by the end of 1965. And the police were considered a crucial element in the process of holding areas once cleared of Viet Cong guerrillas, and to check on all movements within the country, to ferret out suspected Viet Cong agents, and to maintain law and order in the villages where the official link with the central government had broken down. How the program appeared plausible on the face of it, but the question remained, how would the police themselves be secured when even military patrols were not? Even the fortified hamlets with strong local militia forces were subject to guerrilla attack, and often they were attacked precisely because of the military booty they offered, weapons, radio transmitters, medicines, provisions. Logically, the same would apply to any police post that might be established. Police are confronted by the same dilemma as the military. If concentrated in strong points, they fail in their purpose, which is to occupy and govern the rural countryside. Yet if they are scattered through the villages, they'll be too few, and even 50,000 strong, to defend themselves and can be eliminated a single unit at a time. Now, the situation recalls General Ziap's pronouncement, quote, "This war can have only one objective, the occupation and subjugation of the country. The nature and the very aim of the campaign he is conducting oblige the enemy to split up his forces so as to be able to occupy the invaded territory. And during the war against the French, the enemy was thus faced with a contradiction. It was impossible for him to occupy the invaded territory without dividing his forces, and by their dispersal, he created difficulties for himself. His scattered units thus became an easy prey for our troops, and mobile forces dwindled more and more." End quote. Ziap's statement is more than an analysis. In the critical spring of 1965, it could have been taken as a warning to expand the war, to commit sufficient American troops to cope with the exasperating war of the flea in Vietnam. This was an understandable temptation for American military men thinking in terms of military programs and narrow objectives, thinking to stand above politics and to concern themselves only with the outcome of battles. But even in the narrowest military context, could an American Expeditionary Force conquer Vietnam, where a French Expeditionary Force had failed? The French, at least, did not believe so on the basis of their own hard experience. It does appear, President de Gaulle told a news conference in Paris on July 23, 1964, that there can be a military solution in South Vietnam. It is true that certain people imagine that the Americans could seek elsewhere this military solution that they could not find on the spot by extending the war to the north as far as was necessary, and surely they have all the means for this. But it is rather difficult to accept that they could wish to assume the enormous risk of a general war. Then, since war cannot bring a solution, one must make peace. This implies a return to the agreement made 10 years ago. End quote. To return to the conditions of the decade ago would be to return to the terms of a treaty binding on Ho Chi Minh and his government, but not clearly binding on the South Vietnamese insurgents, by which the French accepted defeat after a war had cost them $5 billion and 172,000 dead, wounded, and missing, a struggle in which the Viet Minh, too, had paid dearly for the independence of the North with some 300,000 casualties. Now, it seemed highly unlikely that the Viet Cong could be persuaded to accept in 1965, after another decade of sacrifice, a return to the conditions of 1954. Why should they? Now, on the other hand, there was little doubt that they would be inclined to accept a political victory that they had not yet been able to achieve by military means. And as U.S. Deputy Ambassador Hugh Alexis Johnson summed up the outlook for a negotiated peace in an interview with Life in November of 64, quote, "Their present strategy is designed towards bringing about negotiations between some government in Saigon and their political arm, which is the National Liberation Front. This negotiation would be directed towards formation of a coalition government. The second step would be for the NLF to take over the government, and the third step would be integration with North Vietnam." End quote. Such a solution had already been ruled out in Washington, but in military statement, political pressure in Saigon could easily reach the explosion point at which a popular decision could override the American policy and sweep away any government that supported it. Meanwhile, the War of the Fleet continued, a war now of plague proportions. The Fleet can endure. His war is fought in space and time, and each passing day raises the third factor of protracted revolutionary war, the will of the people to resist. And since their opponent could not say the same, the outcome, barring an extension of the struggle that might become general war, seemed to be a foregone conclusion. The record stands. No colonial war has yet been lost by a colonial people once entered into. Lessons from the past. Now, this first one here is from the USA Today. And it was updated on 26 June 2018. Sentinel Lace Flyer, Texas deputy, touched a piece of paper and ended up in the hospital. A Texas deputy was treated at the hospital and then released on Tuesday after she touched a flyer suspected of being laced with fentanyl, a potent and potentially deadly opioid. The sergeant found the flyer on her windshield, removed it, and soon began feeling lightheaded. Harris County Sheriff Ed Gonzalez said. She went to the hospital for treatment, according to Gonzalez. A Tuesday afternoon tweet from the sheriff's office said the deputy was treated for possible fentanyl exposure and released from the hospital. An investigation revealed that the flyer had been placed on more than 10 vehicles and one of the flyers tested positive for fentanyl, Gonzalez said. A positive fentanyl test did not come from the flyer on the sickened sergeant's vehicle, but all flyers are currently being tested, a spokesman for the Harris County Sheriff's Office told USA Today in an email. The flyer was found on cars near a precinct that houses the Houston Area Sheriff's Department Violent Crime Unit and Homicide Divisions. We're on high alert at this time because, obviously, with this being a police facility, we don't know if it was intended to target law enforcement or perhaps it was a randomly placed here, Gonzalez said. When Gonzalez said the department was unsure if the flyer had been widely distributed, and there was other things. And like I say, I found kind of conflicting. One said it did, one said it didn't. They only had rudimentary testing, and they sent it to a better-equipped lab, and they found nothing. I don't know. I kind of get humorous when they use some of these terms, like the drug war, and they'll say they have a joint operation, or now that the sheriff's deputy touched a piece of paper that possibly was tainted with fentanyl, now they're on high alert. I find it's my sixth sense of humor. We touched on some of this before also. Let's see, we got about 8-9 minutes here. So we touched the deal of about Nicaragua, and I've been covering a little bit of that, here's and there's. And this first one here is out of insightcrime.org. It was written on 22 June 2018. Could Nicaragua parapolice groups turn criminal? Armed parapolice groups have played a central role in the violent repression of the opposition protesters in Nicaragua over the past several weeks. But it remains to be seen if these groups will evolve into political shock troops, into criminal organizations, engage in activities like extortion and kidnapping. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets in Nicaragua in recent weeks to protest the government of President Daniel Ortega, which has responded to the demonstrations with deadly force. In addition to state security forces, armed pro-government groups described as parapolice have been implicated in the deaths of at least 150 and possibly more than 200 people since the start of the unrest, according to local non-government organizations. Several police officers, pro-government activists, and other citizens have also been killed during the unrest. A police source told the investigative Nicaraguan news website Confidencial that these parapolice groups are made up of local gang members, plainclothes police officers, and members of a pro-government organization known as the Sandinista Youth. The source said the government pays parapolice members between 300 and 500 cordobas, around $10 to $15 for a day's work. Images of these groups show them wearing masks to cover their faces while entering communities in teams, usually armed with what appears to be small firearms and other weapons, though some appear to be using high-caliber guns. Opposition activists and independent researchers have accused the government of condoning and even aiding the brutality attributed to the parapolice, including possible extrajudicial executions. The use of these groups makes it harder to attribute human rights abuses to state security forces. And also, that's the end of that. It's 8 pages long, so there you kind of got the gist of what could possibly be going on in Nicaragua that not a whole lot of people are reporting on. Talk about fentanyl. This one here is from cbp.gov/newsroom, 28 June 2018. Fentanyl smuggling attempt foiled by Border Patrol agents. 28 June 2018, Yuma, Arizona. Yuma Sector Border Patrol agent sees 5,000 tablets of fentanyl and arrested two after a failed attempt to smuggle the narcotics in their vehicle Wednesday. At approximately 11:50 p.m., Bly Station Integrated Targeting Team agents performed a vehicle stop on a 2009 silver Nissan Altima traveling on the Interstate 10 near Quartzsite. Agents searched the vehicle and discovered 5,000 tablets of fentanyl disguised as oxycodone with a street value of more than $538,000. A 35-year-old male Mexican national and a female 31-year-old United States citizen, both residing in Los Angeles, California, were arrested and will be charged with smuggling of narcotics. The fentanyl in the vehicle were seized. The opioid crisis continues to be a national public health emergency, said Bly Station Patrol Agent in Charge Daniel Parra. Today's seizure represents the contribution and commitment by the United States Border Patrol's specifically the Blythe Border Patrol Station to combat this threat by disrupting the illicit fentanyl supply chain. According to the DEA, blah, 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 goes on and on and on. Now, also, most of the time I cover just these articles out of Arizona, but every once in a while I'll bounce to some other places. CBP.gov/newsroom, 29 June 2018, Del Rio Border Patrol agents apprehend MS-13 gang member. Salvadoran national previously deported. Del Rio, Texas, U.S. Border Patrol agents assigned to the Eagle Pass station arrested a member of Mara Salvatruce, MS-13 criminal gang, who had previously removed from the United States. Our agents' vigilance and hard work have shut the door on an another dangerous criminal trying to re-enter our society, said Del Rio Sector Chief Patrol Agent Felix Chavez. Here in Del Rio Sector, we remain committed to the integrity of our border and the safety of our citizens. On June 26, Border Patrol agents arrested Salvadoran national Luis Barrentos Melendez, 37, near Eagle Pass, shortly after he made an illegal entry by crossing the Rio Grande River. During processing at the Eagle Pass South Station, agents discovered that Barrentos Melendez had been previously removed in September of 62. Record checks also revealed that he is a confirmed member of the notorious MS-13 gang, a violent transnational criminal organization operating in many parts of the United States. Then prior order removal will be reinstated and he faces prosecution under 8 U.S.C. 1328. Illegal entry after removal carries a maximum prison sentence of 20 years in prison. I got a other one here. It's kind of a different, lengthy, more article, and it's from insidecrime.org. Three big questions about Mexico's security policy under AMLO. And that is the 2nd of July. Voters in Mexico elected a new president who has promised to clean up graft-ridden government and move the country away from a deeply entrenched militarized approach to combating organized crime. But this, can his administration achieve these lofty goals? Leftist candidate Andres Manuel López Obrador, known widely as AMLO, secured 53% of the votes in Mexico's July 1 election, some 30% more than second-place finisher Ricardo Anaya from the National Action Party. In a sign of strong rejection of the past administration's failed attempt at curbing crime and violence, José Antonio Meade, the candidate from the governing Institutional Revolutionary Party, secured less than 20% of the vote. While López Obrador has proposed a shift in security policy, it's still unclear how his strategy will take shape in a scenario characterized by record levels of violence and increased fragmentation in the underworld. There are three questions regarding López Obrador's security police before he takes office in December. Can he root out graft? Throughout his campaign and in his acceptance speech, López Obrador stressed the importance of tackling widespread corruption and impunity. Indeed, a 2017 study by the Universidad de las Americas Puebla ranked Mexico as having the highest level of impunity in Latin America, and this systemic political corruption has exacerbated crime and violence nationwide. According to Eric Olson, the director of the Woodrow Wilson Center's Latin American program, these deep institutional problems need to be addressed with clear, concrete steps. Mike Vigil, the former chief of international operations at the Drug Enforcement Administration, told Inside Crime that López, and if you want the rest of that, you can go to insidecrime.org, says it's an 8-page article. I see we're right at the top. Here's another one. Del Rio Border Patrol agents apprehend MS-13 gang member on the 3rd of July. Leader in Iguala case acquitted on additional charges because of torture. More cocaine leaving Ecuador shows flaws in anti-drug strategies. Hello?
A worried man with a worried mind. No one in front of me and nothing behind. There's a woman on my lap and she's drinking champagne. Have white skin, got assassin's eyes, and well-dressed man waiting on the last plane. Standing in the gallows with my head in a noose. Any minute now I'm expecting all hell to break loose. People are crazy and times are strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.
63.